Meine Damen und Herren, guten Abend. Ladies and Gentlemen, Panie Panowie, to be a bit more decentry. Preparing this introduction, I recalled that my very first encounter with Michael Herzog's work took place at this institute. It was almost 10 years ago when I came here from Warsaw as an exchange student. In Stefan Beck's seminar, we read Anthropology, chapter by chapter. I must admit it wasn't an easy encounter, given the fact that I'm not a native speaker. But apart from obvious substantial relevance of Michael Herzfeld's work for our topic, I guess his presence here tonight is evidence that it was a very interesting and inspiring encounter. It is my great pleasure to welcome Michael Herzfeld here at this institute in Berlin. I would like to thank Professor Herzfeld for his positive response to our invitation, in spite of his overseas traveling in the recent time. Before I pass to today's speaker, I would like to say a few words of explanation why we considered Michael Herzfeld while conceptualizing this series. For almost 30 years, Michael Herzfeld has focused his research on Greece, and particularly on Greece. His ethnographies in what he calls, quote, buffer zones between the colonized lands and those as yet untamed, end quote, brought not only a renewed attention of our discipline to the Mediterranean, but most of all, with his term cryptocolony, on which he is going to develop tonight, he put an end to a binary thinking about Europe and non-Europe, colony and post-colony, or colonizers and colonized. Michael Herzfeld is one of the prominent theorists of today's anthropology. His commitment to refined local ethnography yields a critical insight on others situated on the peripheries of Europe. In his work, he consequently traces back human agency caught between realities of subjects' immediate surroundings, simultaneously not losing from sight and reflecting on greater power structures, discourses, and institutions. I guess, and for me, it's a perfect example here is his book, The Body in Politics, where his intense research in artisan workshop on Crete brings him to reflections on what he calls a global hierarchy of value. Currently, Michael Herzfeld is working on cultural heritage in Thailand, and as I learned today, he has completed his third ethnographic film. A list of his books and contributions is very long, but let me mention only a few. I guess the most important for today's topic is anthropology, Anthropology Through Looking Glass, Critical Ethnography in the Margins of Europe, a book where he reflects the status of the other in anthropology, and, already mentioned, The Body in Politics, Artisans and Artifice in the Global Hierarchy of Value. Michael Herzfeld is also an author of significant work on Western bureaucracy, the social production of indifference, exploring the Western roots of bureaucracy, and on cultural dimensions of nation-state, cultural intimacy, social poetics, and the nation-state. I could stand here for the whole evening and reading a list of books, articles, reviews, and contributions of Michael Herzfeld. This is not the point. Let us take the advantage of having Michael Herzfeld here as our guest tonight. The title of today's lecture, Cryptocolonial Convulsions and the Parochialism of the European Power. Michael Herzfeld, the floor is yours.
That's a very old trick, Pavel, taking the notes away from the speaker to see whether he's capable of managing without notes. And I should be. As it is, I'm going to speak from notes and not from a text, so you'll be happy to hear that I am not going to read a text like this for the next hour and a half like Fidel Castro. Okay. Actually, he does it for 9 hours. But I would like to say how very honored I am. I gather it's quite unusual to get such a big audience, and I'm really very touched and honored. Many of you, I think, will know that this was the city in which my parents were born, And my one embarrassment is that I cannot give you this lecture in German. I'm not going to promise to be able to do it next time I come, but somewhere in the next decade or two, I promised myself to remedy this unfortunate deficit. But there have been a few other languages in between, and I'm a great expert in what you might call deferred gratification. So just consider this to be an example of deferred gratification. So, let me tell you a very brief story. After all, as Clifford Geertz says, what do anthropologists do? They tell stories. Well, he said they write, but it's the same thing. Recently, 2 years ago, my, at the time, very bad eyesight was getting me into all sorts of trouble. I would fall down stairs. I was terrified of crossing the road. And by a series of very fortunate events, I met a very distinguished Greek surgeon by the name of Yannis Palikaris, who is one of the inventors of the laser procedure for correcting short sight and long sight, especially short sight. I was so short-sighted that had I been giving you this lecture 2 years ago, I would literally have been doing this, and I would not have been able to wear glasses. I can actually read it without the glasses, but I'm not going to show off when I need my notes. Anyway, I'm showing off, however, for Dr. Palikaris, because what happened was that he took one look at me during a meeting that we were involved in. He's the rector of the University of Crete right now. And he said, you have a problem. You have to come and let me do some examinations. And I thought, well, you know, provincial Greek doctor's office, 15 minutes of quick exams. And it took 4 hours at a battery of machinery that I have never seen in my life before. I discovered, in fact, that the two major ophthalmology centers in Europe are in Grenoble in France and in Heraklion, Crete. So I went back to the States and said, I better find out whether this man is really a fraud or whether it's for real. I was a bit suspicious, obviously. And nobody in the Harvard medical system had ever heard of this man, who, it turned out, had twice been made an honorary citizen of the city of New Orleans, so he's not unknown in America. And I later found out, in fact, that he has a global reputation that is absolutely extraordinary. And I can tell you from the fact that I can now see every one of you very clearly that he is capable of miracles. But the point of the story is the parochialism of a very large country, namely the United States of America. Not that the European Union is altogether lacking in parochialism. And the larger it gets and the more it appears to swallow up countries within it, both the large countries that have played an important role in launching it, Germany, France, the United Kingdom, and so on, but also the EU as a whole, are displaying more and more, I would argue, the cultural proclivities of the United States of America and of the former Soviet Union. And what I mean by that is that they are permitting a downgrading of education. Indeed, they are encouraging a downgrading of education in the hope that a passive and ignorant public will support the increased bureaucratization of everyday life and the neoliberal invasion of the lives of the poor, invasion or worse, I should say, just as has happened in the USA and just, I think, has happened to a very large extent in the former Soviet Union. Now, this may sound like an extreme statement, but I would suggest to you that the larger a country becomes, the easier it is for it to think like a very small place indeed, like a parish, which is the root of the word parochialism. And the point of my talk today is to suggest to you that using the examples of two countries, one European, Greece, and the other in Asia, Thailand, we can look at countries that were not formally under the colonial yoke and deduce certain things about this dynamic, both in terms of how it has come about in this form, and secondly, to what extent it affects people's everyday lives and in what ways it affects everyday lives. And as I'm an anthropologist, of course, my interest is to know those details very intimately and ethnographically. And so let me start by saying that most of the talk is going to be about Greece and Thailand. And I will give you a number of other examples, but let me just say quickly that the phenomenon, which I will define in a few minutes, could be applied to Nepal, Bhutan, perhaps Ethiopia, perhaps China, more arguably Japan, and so on. Now, in the spirit of not being dichotomous, as Pavel pointed out, I would also say I don't want to end up simply creating another taxonomy, that there are colonial countries, non-colonial countries, and crypto-colonial countries. That's no improvement. Threes are no better than twos. Or Dumézil is no better than Lévi-Strauss. Okay? But I do think that it is useful to have as a heuristic model a concept that breaks apart that dichotomy of the colonized and the colonizers in ways that then allow us to think about the dynamics of power as they continue after the ostensible collapse of the colonial empires, if in fact you believe that they have collapsed. And of course, one of the signs of the parochialism of countries like the United States is the fact that increasingly small numbers of Americans speak anything other than English, or what they call English. That's the parochialism of a Brit. Because I'm a displaced Brit who's lived in the States for 30 years. My parents, growing up in Germany, thought it was absolutely normal to speak fluent English and French as children, and to know at least Latin, if not, as in the case of my father, ancient Greek as well. I suspect that very few of you do that, although the level of English instruction in this country still puts both Britain and America to shame when it comes to the languages taught there. Because I was the child of refugees, I grew up with a healthy respect for languages, and I did learn at least some other languages. And my students, I should tell you, just so that you know how lucky you are not to have me as a professor in your department, are required to give a lecture in the academic language of the country in which they work before I will sign the PhD certificate. And the reason for this has to do with respect for local colleagues. I am sick and tired of Anglo-Saxon and French anthropologists in particular, who go to countries and say, I'm an expert in your culture, but I'm not going to tell you in your language what it is that I'm saying about your culture. And yet expect our Greek, Thai, and other colleagues to come to the United States and lecture in English. Hence my very real embarrassment about speaking to you in English, and let me say that while I may not come across as a very humble person, a measure of humility is a good idea for an anthropologist. All right, Greece and Thailand. The images of these countries in the West have been both flattering and unflattering. But to the extent that they have been flattering, it has been in a form that is hardly helpful. So, for example, Greece is seen as the land of the four S's, you know, sun, sea, sand, and sex. The image that is most commonly portrayed in my generation is that of Zorba the Greek, and for the younger generation, it would be, I suppose, my big fat Greek wedding, and I'll come back to that in a second. But there's the image of the Greeks as the descendants of their ancient forebears, Pericles and all the rest, which comes out in the big fat Greek wedding because you may remember one of the characters gets annoyed with his American in-laws and says in a guttural Greek accent, look, my people were building the Acropolis when you were running around in bearskins. So that's the image that is portrayed of the Greeks very often in the West. And of course, another example of that is the very famous film Never on Sunday, in which the protagonist, the late Melina Mercouri, who then became Minister of Culture of her country, portrayed the role of a prostitute. Now, fast forward or fast sideways to the land of smiles, amazing Thailand, which certainly also has an official face, the face, first of all, of a monarchy that is very widely revered, although perhaps a little less than is claimed publicly. That is the home of Buddhist meditation and of another ancient culture. But you have the same strange situation, a country that is respected for its ancient for its ancient monuments and its ancient traditions, but at one and the same time is also despised as being a place of prostitution. All the tourists rush off to Patpong Road, and there was a huge German sex industry in Thailand until a few years ago, when a group of conscientious German citizens actually decided to begin activist revolt against this. Now, my point in bringing these two examples, oh, and by the way, the film version, I think the one that everyone knows is The King and I, which is so offensive to Thai that it's actually banned in Thailand. It's banned because it's historically inaccurate, it's offensive to the monarchy, and it also portrays the Thai, the Siamese, as they then were, as simpering mendicants and imitators of the West. Now, I'm going to go back to Greece for a second and tell you a story again, for which I expect some kind of reaction, and we'll see how this works. At the height of the Macedonian conflict in the early 1990s, a very respectable daily newspaper in Athens, Eleftherotypia. How many people, by the way, the people here speak Greek? Anyone? No one? Well, you do, of course. Okay, Thai? Okay, I can get away with anything, right? At the height of this tense period, Eleftherotypia ran an opinion article, an op-ed piece, in which the author said the following: the West should stop laughing at us and should stop accusing us of myopia, hysteria, and paranoia, because these are all Greek words. Yeah, well, that laugh was not very strong. If this is an American audience, maybe you can see what's coming. Because I was going to tell you, if I did this in front of an American audience, people would be already laughing quite openly, that that bubbling up of laughter in your own bodies is the imprint of what I'm calling crypto-colonialism on all of us, and we're all implicated. Our bodies are as much implicated in the colonial project as are those of the people who were colonized, but perhaps in different ways. Now, the fact that you didn't immediately burst out laughing, I think, shows an appropriate sense of restraint and decorum and perhaps respect for the Greeks, and more knowledge given an anthropological audience in a European country than I would get from a bunch of 20-year-old American undergraduates. But nonetheless, there was some, and you shouldn't feel guilty about it. We're all implicated. I as much as anyone here. But the point I want to make is that it's important to recognize that. Okay. Now, two more things that you may have noticed in journalistic accounts of both countries. The recent financial problems of Greece, attributed by one newspaper after another in virtually all the major European languages to an endemic Mediterranean inability to organize anything properly. The alternative story, of course, is that your chancellor played electoral politics with Greece's economy and thereby started the whole series of events that has now got the Portuguese, the Spanish, and even perhaps the Italians and the Irish into very serious trouble. But that's not the story the newspapers told, because for the newspapers, both in the United States and in Western Europe, it was much easier to evoke the same old stereotypes, to say, look, this is all the result of an endemic Mediterranean inability to organize an economy. About the same time, the red shirts and the yellow shirts started duking it out in the streets of Bangkok. And this was not a coincidence, and I will come back to the fact that these things happened within a few weeks of each other later on in my talk. But again, we are dealing with journalistic representations of a third world country that could not be expected to do anything right when handed something approaching a democratic system. And of course, just as we laugh at the Greeks for saying it's always the foreign finger, we're not responsible for things that go wrong, and just as we say the Thais are trying to wriggle their way out of it because there's such a high level of corruption that they don't want anyone to see, we should remember that the reason that there is a high level of patronage in these countries is because the model of those countries' relationships with us is one of patronage. In other words, patronage is sustained, even if it existed from previous periods, it's sustained in countries that are part of more or less the Western Alliance, because for the European Union and for the United States, it has always been relatively convenient to maintain in power some of the most corrupt politicians. Because after all, in this way, one could be sure that they would do the bidding of the West. But those politicians reproduce the same pattern. As Goetz would say, it's turtles all the way down. You get the same pattern being reproduced at every level. And the other similarity that I want to point out to you is that both countries have a double nomenclature. They have two names. Greece in Greek is, of course, Elas or Elava, but many Greeks refer to themselves, not so much now, but they used to refer to themselves not as Hellenes, Elines, but as Romi, literally Romans, descendants of the East Roman Empire with its capital in Constantinople, now Istanbul, of course, in Turkey. This duality expresses also the two major ideological currents in modern Greek cultural history. On the one hand, the pro-Western conservative side that wanted to be connected to ancient Greece, an ancient Greece that had nothing to do with most of what we now think of as Greece and everything to do with Athens, a very small part of the picture, and from which any trace of anything Turkish, Arabic, etc. in the modern version was ruthlessly removed, again very often with the help of Western folklorists and philologists. That's a story I've told in other contexts. In Thailand, you have exactly the same phenomenon, because there is the name Siam, or Siam in English, Siam being a name of a loosely jointed system of a kingdom with vassal statelets, essentially, related to the center through ties of patronage and dependency, which is then replaced in the modern age by a clearly demarcated national frontier, a centralized bureaucracy, and ultimately a renaming of the country with a wonderful piece of political philology, because the word Thai is often claimed to mean free man, although there's some evidence that in the 14th century it actually meant exactly the opposite. It meant a conscripted soldier. We're not quite sure about that. But in any case, the modern name of the country, Tathai Thai, is a formalism that says we are ethnically Thai, and we have boundaries and frontiers like every other modern country built on the Western model, which was not certainly the case when the present dynasty began its reign in 1782. At that point, the entire country was what my colleague at Harvard, Stanley Tavares, described as a pulsating galactic polity, by which he meant that it was a polity that moved to and fro, in which relations among the various parts were not stable, but the whole thing was designed very much on the model of the Buddhist mandala, not on the model of modern Western cartography. And the Thai historian Tongchai Winichakwan, in a very famous book called Siam Mapped, points out that it was in fact cartography that became the instrument for the creation of the modern Thai state. Just as E.R. Wilkinson in England, writing a very prescient book about Balkan ethnographic cartography, pointed out that exactly the same process happened in all of Southeastern Europe, including, of course, Greece. But my point here is that you have two countries that are suspiciously alike in having this kind of double naming, in which one name is retained as the official name of the country. So you have... can I use the board?
Yes, this would be actually quite helpful. So you have... one name, which is, in the case of Greece, would be Hellas or Elava. Actually, let me put it in its form, Elas. Okay? And then you have this notion, an abstract notion of Romiosini, a theme of Romi. That's the contrast there. And they come together in modern speech because the modern name of the country in everyday speech is Elada. Okay? Because I guess there are secret Greek speakers. And this word is a demoticism. It's derived from this, but it has implications in both. So it brings the two together. And in Thailand, you have, on the one hand, Siam. I'm going to do it the other way around. Here you have the Thai state, which is the formal Thailand. And then you have Siam, which is the empire that has a lot of minorities and other groups under it, and it's all considered to be rather in flux. And eventually, it comes together in this notion of Ratet Thai, Thailand. However, there is another word, Mung Thai, which is often used, and that's the compromised version, because the Mung is a segmentary polity. In other words, village, town, province, everything can be a Mung, including the nation state. So some sense of this other, more fluid entity lingers on in everyday speech, just as the common use of the word Elada in modern Greek retains a little hint that there are alternatives to that. All right. So,
you'll say, what's this got to do with crypto-colonialism? So we'll have to come to a definition in a moment. But think about what these two countries have in common historically. They both had monarchies. One still does, Thailand. They have powerful monastic traditions, and they have very complex systems of theodicy, the Greeks blaming everything on the doctrine of original sin, the Thais using a Buddhist notion of redemption through reincarnation. And both have, and this is now the crucial point, they both have myths of national independence that were crafted in very large measure in collaboration with foreign powers. Now, there's something ironic about the idea of an independence that is dependent, right? That is dependent on outside forces. So, the definition now of crypto-colonialism is that it is a form of colonialism that is indirectly expressed through the invention of a national identity that the country is allowed to enjoy, indeed encouraged to enjoy, on condition that it does so in the terms dictated to it by outside forces. Now, of course, to some extent, all post-colonial societies tend to have a little bit of that too. And again, I don't want to say this is an absolute new taxonomy that's going to supersede everything else. I want to use this as a heuristic device. But it seems to me very useful to think about these two countries, both of which have been strategically important, first to the British and the French in the 19th century, and all the way up to the Second World War. And after the Second World War, frontline countries of strategic importance to the United States. Indeed, so similar is their geopolitical history in this respect that I have sometimes joked that it would be a great idea to open a Department of Southeastern Studies, never mind which continent, right? Because you can actually see that the positioning of a country that is between, first of all, a communist north and an Islamic south, right, that has semi-nomadic peoples on its borders who complicate things by wandering across those borders that were a condition for the original recognition of this conditional independence, and that also move from a landmass into an island chain, an archipelago, that the similarities in their strategic and geographical formulation would probably also encourage some similarities in the way that they were treated by the West, and I would argue that this is precisely what has happened. And the evidence is both historical and ethnographic. So the paradox of crypto-colonialism is that these countries have to boast about their freedom, because on the one hand, they've not been admitted to the post-colonial grumbling club. They can't complain that all of their ills came from being having been colonized, because that would undermine the way in which their authority has been constructed for them. They've walked straight into the trap. Maybe they had no choice. They find themselves in a trap created for them by the Western powers, and buttressed in both countries by a system of law that is based very largely, you'll be pleased to hear, on German legal positivism, and that also shows signs of extreme positivism in the way in which social science research, for example, is conducted. And the state itself is an embodiment of positivistic values. Indeed, in my book on Bangkok, which I'm in the process of writing, I intend to title the first chapter, The Positivistic State, just to remind people that a philosophical doctrine may actually be quite important for understanding why countries act in the ways that they do. In any case, let me give you a little bit of the historical parallels. This will make it come much, much more real to you, I think. In 1860, the British and the French besieged the port of Piraeus, the port of Athens, because they wanted to prop up the Bavarian king Otto, of course, but Othon in Greek, who was not very popular anymore with the Greek populace. At the same time, the British and the French were, by turns, blockading Klong Toei, the port of Bangkok, because they wanted to force the Siamese into various kinds of trade concessions. As a result of both sets of actions, various agreements were made, and Thailand in particular, or Siam as it still was, became very much a trading partner on terms dictated to it by Britain and France. Fast forward to the Second World War. Greece invaded by Germany. Thailand not invaded, but certainly controlled to some extent by the Japanese. Both countries, after the Second World War, falling very neatly into the hands of the Western powers as part of their front line of defense against communism. In Greece, as a result of these events, the minority populations were treated with great suspicion, especially those that were semi-nomadic or transhuman, because they wandered across borders that were supposed to be hermetically sealed, and because they refused to adopt the national language in some cases, and in many cases also appeared to have sympathies that were cultural as well as political with populations now under communist rule. And so one effect of this was that between 1944 and, say, 1992, you get a progressive cutting back of the rights of minorities, even as Greece entered the European Union and signed treaties that committed it to the principle of ethnic self-determination. And you notice that neither Germany, nor Britain, nor France has ever protested the Greeks' treatment of their minorities, and have allowed successive Greek governments to get away with what is essentially a major violation of EU law. Why? Because it suited their interests. This was the same border that Greece is now defending, quote-unquote, against the influx of refugees from other countries. The Schengen border, in other words. In Thailand, ostensibly, things went exactly the other way. The Thais said that no person who was not a native speaker of a Thai language group member and could prove that they had been born on Thai territory was entitled automatically to Thai citizenship. This meant that most of the slash and burn Sweden culture, agriculturalists living in the mountainous areas of north and northeast Thailand were denied the rights of citizenship and therefore denied access to the most basic education and health care, which in turn perpetuated their marginal status. Now, you'd say these are two opposite principles, but the effects, you notice, are exactly the same. That is that these populations get treated as a problem, a bureaucratic problem. Those of you who are familiar with Mary Douglas's classic book, Purity and Danger, will immediately recognize this treatment of people who don't fit in as matter out of place, and somehow soiling the body politic as being excluded from the country. So right there you have a geopolitical reason for which control over these two countries was very important to the West, and that also became a basis for nationalistic definitions of ethnic identity in ways that in turn triggered the demand for more and more autonomy by the various ethnic groups in Greece, whereas in Thailand most of these groups were desperate to get Thai citizenship simply so that they would have access to good schools, medical care, and so on. Fast forward again to 1973. The students of Thammasat University rise in revolt against the brutal military dictatorship, and essentially by the following year brought it down. It was soon restored in a slightly less direct form, but it was the students who triggered the process, and the Americans this time did nothing because they had finally woken up to the, to them, very strange notion that encouraging dictators was not a way to win friends among the general population. 2 months later, at the Polytechnic in Athens, the students rose in revolt against the colonels. And some of them held up placards that said, "Edo Thailandi," here is Thailand. They had heard of crypto-colonialism long before I came up with the idea. They knew that the Thai situation was dramatically similar to their own, and they were actually more successful than the Thais in that they triggered a series of events that in 1974, pushed over the brink by the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, the Greek colonels fled, were caught and put in prison, and democracy was restored, largely thanks to one man, Konstantin Karamanlis, who had good conservative credentials and took over, but then having studied social sciences in Paris, apparently decided that it was better not to be a dictator and instead presided over one of the most remarkable transitions to democracy to take place that year when Portugal and Spain, of course, went through the same process. And I will say about Karamanlis, who was a pretty evil prime minister when he was first in power in the 1950s, that by 1981, he had acquired the wisdom to understand that the only way to guarantee democracy in his country was to lose an election. So he made sure that his successor as leader of his party was a complete non-entity and something of an idiot, and thereby made sure that Andreas Papandreou, leader of the revolution and son of the prime minister whose resignation had triggered the colonel's takeover in 1967, to become the next prime minister. And in fact, it's his son who is now trying to grapple with the problems of the Greek economic crisis. Now, throughout these stories, we see that things are happening because either the West does or doesn't allow them to happen. And the arrival of the students, an educated population, on the scene made the Americans realize that at this point they have nothing to gain by supporting such corrupt and tyrannical regimes. And so in Greece, effectively, crypto-colonialism began to wither. Although that article about those words being Greek words and therefore the West shouldn't accuse us of being historical and all the rest of it, shows that some of these ideas continue to this day. There are other signs that the Greeks are still in a crypto-colonial situation. One is the fact that whereas the Thai historians and others led by Tongchai Winichakun actually enthusiastically picked up this notion of crypto-colonialism, and it's now become very much part of the discourse of Thai historiography. They translated it directly into Thai, Ananikum Amprang in Thai, no problem at all. The Greeks were much more reluctant to pick it up, and my suspicion, although I can't prove this, is that it was partly because they were offended, having after all been taught that they, my God, were Europeans, were being compared with an Asian society. Because they would often, Greek colleagues of high level of education, would often laugh condescendingly about my stories about Thailand, and particularly when I explained to them, you know, Greeks are convinced, of course, that the Greek language is the most difficult and sophisticated language in the world. When I said that Thai is a tonal language and therefore it's very hard for us to hear the sounds as separate, but in fact the language of great complexity, they said, oh, you mean they just use one word for all the same things? Right? So, you know, this attitude died very hard. Just to show you how hard it died, let me tell you another little anecdote. I arrived in Athens right after the Olympic Games. Now, everybody in Greece has noticed that with the arrival, the success in getting the Olympic Games, Greek behavior on the streets had become very different. Much more polite, much more formal. And people will tell you this in Greece itself. But I came out of the baggage claim area into the place where you get a taxi. And to my astonishment, there were no little old ladies banging each other over the head with their handbags to grab a taxi and tripping each other up and generally creating mayhem. There was a line standing in perfect order, and I said in a voice of total surprise, in Greek, of course, what's happened? Why is everybody standing in line waiting for the cabs? And two people turned to me and said, sir, we have become European. And I wanted to say, by saying that, you show that you are, in fact, still enthralled to an ideology that oppresses you. But I didn't have the heart. They were so happy. But that's the problem, you see, because you can, of course, buy people off with an ideology that appears to give them self-respect while it takes them away, which is the fundamental principle of crypto-colonialism. It gives you the respect of acknowledging your independence while making sure that you're not really independent at all. That's why it's crypto. And I would say a less honest form of colonialism than the straight variety. Now, Greece in 2010 was the scene of pretty nasty rioting, some bombs going off, and there are still bombs being sent, apparently, from Greek sources to embassies around the world. And particularly in my third field country, Italy, people are beginning to wonder what my role in all of this is, but I assure you that I don't have one. The journalists have taken all of this as further evidence that the Greeks are a typical Mediterranean people and quite incapable of organizing anything, and gleefully predicting when the Greek economy would collapse in its entirety. Indeed, within Greece, there are some voices saying we should forget about the euro, restore the drachma, and go our own way. And the very fact that this is regarded as totally ridiculous by most people, including most Greeks, is itself an indication of how totally Greece has now been locked into the EU system. One feature of the uprising in Greece, as indeed elsewhere in Europe, and indeed here in Germany as well, is the fact that there is a glut of people with PhDs. The PhDs themselves have become less and less valuable because the Bologna plan has ensured, and we anthropologists feel this very keenly, because how can you do serious fieldwork if you have to learn a language, spend a year in the field, write up, know what's going on theoretically, write up your work and so on, if you can only do the whole thing in 3 years flat? It's very difficult. And the Australians have already discovered this, which is why so many Americans seem to be getting jobs in Australian departments. You might want to tell your lords and masters about that so they don't repeat the mistake, but I think it's probably too late. In any case, so you have more and more people with high-looking qualifications of less and less value. I don't want to speak to any of you as being in that situation. Some institutions always do rise to the top of the heap, and some disciplines, and I think anthropology here has a very special role, are also eccentric enough to be able to resist consciously what seems to be a global process. But overall, you've got a lot of people with much more education on paper, worth a great deal less in terms of what they really know, and unable to get jobs. And that's exactly what's happened in Thailand. Thailand, of course, has nothing to do with the EU, but Thailand is a country that has pursued a reified notion of knowledge. There have been vast splits between different parts of the country because the northeast, which is very poor, has not had equal access to these advantages, and people of Bangkok on the whole are in a very different situation. But they are unhappy as well because there's no work for them. And there's no work that's commensurate with the level of education that they think they've achieved, because they all have masters and a few of them actually have PhDs. And in Thailand, it's not the hegemony of the European Union, it's the hegemony of the IMF in large measure, but the effect is extremely similar. And what you see then is the red shirts representing the people coming in from the northeast for the most part, not all of them, but many of them, some actually not without landed property of their own, but certainly feeling themselves aggrieved because their part of the country has, they claim, been neglected by the central government, much as the Cretans say the same thing in Greece, actually. And then, on the other hand, the yellow shirts, representing the ultimate in condescension, saying the people are still too ignorant to be able to vote and know what they're doing. So we think that 30% of the parliamentarians could be elected by a popular suffrage, and the other 70% should be appointed by the palace and the army. And guess who's behind that? The palace and the army, of course. But the yellow shirts are also reproducing at the local level the attitude of the West that says, well, you know, what do you expect? Thailand's a third world country. It's an Asian country. They don't understand democracy. And, of course, you all know that Monsieur Sarkozy and George Bush in particular were paragons of democracy, right? So, you know, there's a pattern here, and there's a pattern which is, I think, very, very easy to see. In the community that I work in Bangkok, a little group of 300 people called Pomahakan, the community was actually divided between those who were of northeastern origin and tended, for reasons of geographical sympathy, to support the red shirts, and some who saw the Democrat Party, which is now in power, as having given them one chance of resisting eviction. It's a long story, which I'm not going to be able to go into. That's my current research. But in any case, they had good reason for thinking that they might be able to get some benefit from aligning themselves with the governing party. And what's interesting is that there has been no major fight within the community, unlike what's happened at the national level. So when people are left to do their own thing, they show themselves to be extremely responsible. Indeed, my community has not only conducted all of its business, by the way, this is a community that for 19 years now has had no legitimacy as a community in the eyes of the government. And so it had to do everything on its own. It was officially declared a non-community 19 years ago in order to justify removing the people. And these people have meetings two or three times a week to discuss every problem, whether it's of one family or the entire community. They have completely solved the problem of drug use in the community. There's not a single drug user, as far as I'm able to ascertain, in this community, in the middle of a city that is riddled with drug problems. And they have shown that they're much better at maintaining the cleanliness and order of the historical monuments within their space than the authorities on the streets outside. So the moral of this is not that the people always know. I'm not, in that sense, a romantic anarchist or communist. But the moral is that when people are left to their own devices, and especially when, more than that, they are being pushed very hard by those with power, they feel that it's incumbent on themselves to show that they can actually organize themselves, and they do so. But what is happening elsewhere in the country is that both sides are saying, we know better what is good for the country, and so we're going to dictate the forms of political action to you. And I would argue that this situation has largely come about because, again, the colonial powers, indirectly as it may be, are still encouraging a divide-and-conquer strategy in dealing with these border zones. Thailand and Greece remain important to the Western alliance because they still represent a frontier, now less against communism than against Islam. So the enemy, quote-unquote, has changed, but the lines are still very much in place. And it's not coincidental that in Thailand there's a virtual civil war going on in the three southernmost predominantly Muslim provinces, while in Greece there's a great deal of unrest in Thrace, where the vast majority of Greece's now very small Muslim population is located. And it's also perhaps interesting to note that while the West tends to point a derisory finger and say, you people are riddled with corruption, the fact of the matter is that the forms of corruption, although they may date back to structures that were in existence before the West was interested in this part of the world, nonetheless reproduce, as I said earlier on in this talk, the relationship between the West and these countries themselves. And indeed, I would argue that the United States in particular is the only country possibly in the world, maybe with the exception of Spain, that manages to be post-colonial and imperial at the same time. It's post-colonial culturally, and let me tell you what having a British accent does for you in the United States. People get very annoyed, because what happens is they first express a great deal of admiration. You know, you people from the old world have such high culture. If you dare to agree with them, of course, they become very angry. But it's also an imperial power, and arguably it's also even a crypto-colonial state, in the sense that it is still governed by powers. We don't necessarily even know where these sources of power are emanating from, but it's pretty clear now that there are financial interests in the world that are much stronger in some respects. We don't have to get into elaborate conspiracy theories to make this point, than any nation-state government. Now, I said that I would talk about the consequences in everyday life, and I think that one can see very quickly that these things filter down very quickly. As I take my sip of water, let me say that one place where you see it immediately is in food habits. And anthropologists love to eat, so let me give you some examples. In Greece, the food has become increasingly westernized. People are much more reluctant than they used to be to share a common salad, for example. In the urban, especially the bourgeois places, you will notice in Athens that the fashionable restaurants all have French and Italian names. We were talking earlier, one of the most expensive restaurants now in downtown Athens is ironically called Cucina Povera, which I think shows you that the commodification of poverty is itself a phenomenon that is part of this global hierarchy of value that Pavel was kind enough to mention. And I would argue that the crypto-colonial countries are perfect mirrors of that hierarchy. In Thailand, eating habits. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Thai food, but one of the things that's really amusing when you go to a Thai restaurant, if you speak Thai, you hear the comments from the waiters saying, look at those Pharang, those white foreigners, they are trying to use chopsticks with these very runny liquid curries, and more to the point, they're trying to eat them with a fork. Now, Thais never, if they have what they call marayat or politeness, never put the fork in the mouth. So the body is trained to use Western utensils in a non-Western way. You use the fork to scoop and the spoon to cut and put the food in your mouth. And if you put the food in your mouth with your fork, you're a rebel, you're a rambunctious teenager, or you're an aristocrat who's risen above it so far that you don't care, or you've lived in the West and you're trying to prove how sophisticated you are. But if you are a Thai, or if you're a respectful foreigner, you eat with spoon and fork two-handed, and you never put the fork in the mouth. Now, this may seem like a very trivial thing, but think about it. The spoon and the fork are Western imports. The rules for using them are not. The implication is precisely that in the training of children, superficially they are being brought into the West because that is the concession that the Siamese polity had to make in the 19th century in order not to lose all its territory, as the Cambodians or the Vietnamese did, you see, to the French in particular, but also to the British. The French took Laos, which was the Thais regard as part of Thailand, and Cambodia. The British took Burma and Malaya. Malaya had bits of that Muslim area the other bit of which is still within Thailand. So you see there's a pattern here. The geopolitics are connected to the way people eat. And the tensions in Thai society are also very much in this mode. So a lot of Thais, when they are hosting foreigners, will deliberately try to make the food less spicy, partly because they think that foreigners can't eat food that is that spicy, partly, I suspect, because this is a way of saying the foreigners really are not very capable. I was very surprised when I started to speak Thai to discover the fact that I happen to like ferociously hot food would often occasion the comment, "You're good at this," as if it was some special skill to eat spicy food. I use the word geng, which means to be capable, competent at doing something. And so that was one part of the story, but the other part of the story was that, of course, people who were Thai and didn't like spicy food had to find an excuse. Now, that was not that they were being Western sophisticated. They either said, "Oh, I'm of Chinese descent," which is true for 90% of the people of Bangkok anyway, to some degree, or, "I'm a good Buddhist, and Buddhism doesn't allow us to excite the senses." And this is the same kind of argument. Now we go back to the middle level, that you will see when people are trying to explain why it is that the Thai state is so literal-minded in its application of the law, why it is so positivistic. Ah, they say, this comes straight from Buddhism. In other words, we are going to make claims, rather like the claims of Asian values that you see coming out of Singapore and China these days. We're going to make claims about the local nature of what makes us siwilai. Guess what that means, right? Siwilai. Okay, what makes us siwilai, it doesn't come from the West, it comes from us. We're going to make those claims in defiance of all the evidence, because this is a way we can put on this Western veneer and then claim it as our own. So whether we're talking about the apparently very mundane business of how you eat, or the more encompassing business of how you philosophically explain the relationship between the citizen and the state, what you're looking at is a discourse of independence that was fashioned again in the West. So there is your crypto-colonial presence in everyday life. The Greek equivalent of this is not hard to find either, because the Greeks will attribute everything that is of considered to be importance to the ancient Greeks. Those of you who've been to Greece or seen the big fat Greek wedding will know this. But, who invented that picture of ancient Greece? Well, most of it was invented in what is today Germany, in the late 18th century, names and the early 19th century. So names like Winckelmann and Wilhelmowitz Möllendorf, all of these people who were involved in constructing the image of Hellas, but who in fact were doing analyses of culture of which they knew very little, and all of it was being attributed to Athens rather than to Greece, Hellas as a whole. The most egregious example of this was Winckelmann's insistence that ancient Greek statues were white. One can see a linear connection between this and Nazi race theory, okay? The idea that white skin is superior, therefore these white representations of the Greeks had to be that way. And the Greeks lovingly clung to this idea until a few years ago. Recently there was, for the very first time, and this shows you they're finally throwing off this crypto-colonial shackle, an exhibition of statues showing the original, to our way of thinking, garish, kitschy kind of ornamentation, all in primary colors, bright blues, reds, and yellows. Okay? So, clearly, the image of ancient Greece, with which the Greeks would constantly say, "We are the descendants of our ancient forebears. You cannot call us hysterical because it's one of our words, not one of yours, and you better come up with some of your own if you want to have the right to do this." All of which, of course, becomes a trap, in the same way that a Thai eating with a spoon and fork in the West is regarded as not having very good manners, because that's not the way it's done. We invented those utensils, remember? So this concatenation in both countries reproduces something many of you will know from post-colonial societies, but in the case of Greece and Thailand, it is a lie to a notion that, after all, we have never been under the West. A statement than which nothing could be less true. Thailand and Greece, as nation-states, would not exist today had they not suited the convenience of the Western powers. The consequences, then, for people's everyday lives have been enormous, and as we know from our readings of writers like Pierre Bourdieu, bodily hexis reproduces and perpetuates many of the patterns of domination that we absorb with our mother's milk and thereafter, and especially when we start to drink Coca-Cola. So the pattern that I've tried to sketch out for you today is one intended to show that the convulsions of recent time, the recent months, especially during 2010, convulsions that are likely to increase and spread in both Bangkok and Athens, are the result of a continuing series of inequalities sustained by the crypto-colonial organization, not so much of political power, though that's also central, but of cultural value, the global hierarchy of value again, by a Europe that increasingly knows less and less about the countries over which it exercises this kind of dominion. And not just Europe, the United States as well, I have to say. If you ask anyone in the foreign ministry today or here in Germany, well, in Germany, actually, you might find somebody. But if you ask somebody in the Foreign Office in London or in the State Department in the United States to tell you something detailed about ancient Greek democracy, which they keep pointing to, as you know, the Americans like to cite Jefferson. Jefferson did know his classical history. These guys don't. Even Hillary Clinton, I lay odds, knows very little about that history. So the vaguer it becomes, the more useful it is as the basis of a stereotype that continues to keep these marginal countries marginal. Their marginality is not a fact, except in the sense that it is something constructed for them by a global arrangement that is today kept in place less by military force and more by economic and cultural power. And so this is the situation in which we find ourselves. And I would argue that the dangers for Europe of not waking up to its own ignorance of the way in which it has acted towards these countries are very considerable indeed. What those dangers actually will become, what form they will take, I'm not a prophet and I'm not a political scientist, or a political scientist who thinks he's a prophet. But I do know that in both of these countries, and I spend a lot of time in both of them, people's everyday lives continue to be dominated by what is acceptably civilized in terms that come from outside. And as long as that situation is sustained by countries that know less and less about their own history and about the history of their involvement in these places, the likelihood of a cultural, political, and economic explosion increases exponentially day by day. Thank you.